So my name is John Frame. I'm an undergrad at Hopkins, a double major in math and econ, and I'm taking a course with Dr. Dvorkin to interview a prominent researcher on his field and see his perspective and the changes in the field of astronomy in the last 35 years. So, hi, Professor Feldman. So I guess obviously the air of the industry was way different when you got involved. And as a child, I know, you know, when I grew up, a lot of the things that made me interested about, you know, physics and astronomy, it's what I wanted to do when I first came here was photos of the night sky. But, you know, and obviously photos from back then were different. We don't have the same clarity because I read of, you know, we had the Palomar Observatory in California. But the resolution from that, because we were hindered by the atmosphere, was, you know, it wasn't as high resolution shots. So what basically got you interested in astronomy?
Okay, it's a relatively long story, but I can make it short.
Yeah.
As a child growing up in New York, I was a member of the Junior Astronomy Club, which is at the Hayden Planetarium. And I remember my father had to drag me into Manhattan to attend the meetings. And I used to make star charts and go to their observing sessions. In New York, there wasn't too much in the way of great observatories. But I actually lost that interest and was a physics major as an undergraduate and as a graduate student. I got my PhD in physics. But what happened is my PhD was in 1964, and my thesis advisor, Robert Novick, had gotten very interested in space following Sputnik and the buildup of NASA and the ability to fly physics-type experiments on sounding rockets and satellites. Satellites were still away in the future. And he convinced me to take a postdoctoral position in Washington at the Naval Research Laboratory with Herbert Friedman, who was one of the pioneers in flying the German rockets, the V-2s, I guess, in White Sands, New Mexico, and built up a laboratory and an institute in Washington. So I was there for 3 years and learned the field.
Okay, but that's so it was more of a later in your life. It wasn't like a childhood ambition to become necessarily an astronomer.
No, it wasn't a childhood ambition.
just curious, because I know some other people I've spoken to were, you know, adamant about it as a child. But I saw you went to Columbia. Did you have any prior research experience with the sounding rockets, or was that your first, like, you know, because I know a lot of people are doing, you know, like grunt work in labs before, you know, because that sounds like a major endeavor, what you did. So.
Well, I didn't do the sounding rockets until I went to the Naval Research Laboratory.
Okay.
I did a laboratory experiment for my PhD thesis.
What was the dissertation on? Yes, just curious.
Well, it was on metastable alkali atoms, which has nothing to do with astronomy. Yeah. It has a lot to do with physics.
Okay. I guess. I saw you on a lot of papers on ADS, which was, I saw that you've clearly done, you know, plenty of years of research. Did you have a specific research interest specialty going into it?
No, because I sort of was interested in what you can do from space, and the group that I worked with in Washington was doing infrared astronomy, which was very in its infancy, and very difficult technically. It didn't really mature for another 20 years with the IRS satellite, and then with the number of things most recently. The Spitzer Observatory, but when I finished my postdoc, or when I was doing my postdoc and looking for positions, Hopkins was hiring, and they had a group working in ultraviolet astronomy, and that seemed to appeal to me because a lot of the processes that occur in the ultraviolet are actually very much related to the atomic physics I had worked on before.
Oh, well, can I just, you know, it doesn't have to be on record, but can I elaborate on that a little bit? I'm just curious in any way, because if there's any way to explain it simply, you can. If not, then sorry, I'm just
interested. I'll give you a very simple example.
Uh-huh.
What I worked on in the laboratory for my degree was electron excitation of alkali atoms, but now obviously electron excitation can be applied to. I mean, I had an apparatus, and I part of what I did, which is a little bit outside the thesis, was to just put all sorts of other things into the chamber, and so I actually was exciting oxygen and nitrogen and various other things that I could get my hands on. and seeing what came out. I wasn't measuring spectra, I was measuring particles that were produced, atoms that were excited that if they struck a metal plate would cause a count. It's surface material.
Okay, yeah, because I definitely have heard of the electron excitation.
So basically, this is a process which I was familiar with, and it was one of the things when I came to Hopkins. I worked on photoelectron excitation in the Earth's atmosphere, because at that time, doing rockets to look at the Earth's atmosphere was pretty simple. You didn't have to point very accurately. It was in the 70s that NASA developed the sound rocket capability to do fine pointing at astronomical objects in a small, affordable package. And then just recently, I'm working on a Rosetta mission. It's a mission that's flying along with the comet. I've done a lot of comet spectroscopy, but what we observe is very unusual compared to what you observe with Hubble. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's due to photoelectron excitation, so I've come full circle doing the same thing. But recognizing what atomic and molecular processes are relevant in particular astrophysical environments is the tie-in.
That's wow, that's impressive. Yeah, I was considering going to grad school, but I realized I don't know the dedication to get a four or five years on something like that. I don't know if I'm able to stick through that. So that's interesting. Was the math different back then? I don't want to say different. That's not the right term, but. Was before computers, was it all done by hand for the sounding rockets when you were calculating trajectory, et cetera?
Well, I don't know what you mean before computers. I mean,
before modern, because I know now, when I talk to all my friends who do, they do computing or they do some sort of quantitative work, but they did applied math. They say they haven't touched pen and paper in, since school. So I'm curious, it must have been different before,
For analysis, mm-hmm. I actually as a graduate student, I had to calculate some kind of matrix elements for atomic transitions, and we had across the street from Columbia was the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and they were funded pretty lavishly at the time, and they had you probably heard of them because they were very big on climate change.
Okay.
But they had a state-of-the-art IBM 7094 or 704, and we could use their computer. They would let us come over, and we would drag boxes of cards. Have you ever seen computer D-punch cards?
Yeah, definitely.
So we would drag boxes of cards, and we would stick it into their computer. And all we were doing is simple things like matrix multiplication, but it was much faster on a computer than trying to do it by hand.
Okay.
So then when I went to the Naval Research Laboratory, they also had a Controlled Data Corporation computer. I can't remember the model number, but the person I worked with was big into computing, and so I learned assembly language. I didn't quite learn machine code, but I learned assembly language. And did simple things like calculating trajectories and positions, doing transformations between coordinate systems. Mm-hmm. It came pretty quickly, and of course, it just evolved to the point where we have the equivalent of a supercomputer sitting on your desk.
Equivalent to that must have been. So I guess, could you tell me a little bit about your UVX experiment aboard the Shuttle Columbia in the 80s? Because that interested me. It said you flew up. I wasn't really sure. I assume it's ultraviolet X-ray?
No, it was an ultraviolet experiment.
Okay.
It was actually a hodgepodge. It was something that actually Professor Richard Henry was behind. It was an attempt to put NASA had this idea that they could put cheap experiments on a space shuttle. Mm-hmm. And the answer was that you couldn't put cheap experiments on a space shuttle because as long as there were man in space concerns, the safety, hazardous components, gases and things like that, you had to go through a certain degree of rigor in testing and specifications. But the idea was that a gas can was a little cylinder, I don't know, maybe this big, 30 inches around, and we put in some old spectrometers that we had, and the idea was to look at the sky with a large field of view so that you don't see individual stars, but you see what's behind stars. And we observed, I think the thing that came out of it was measurement of the zodiacal light. This is the dust in the solar system.
Okay.
I'm not sure what. I wasn't the prime mover behind it, so it wasn't one of my favorite.
Wasn't your favorite position? What was your favorite?
Well, I guess what was my favorite then were some of the Sandy rockets that we did for comets.
Okay, definitely.
Those were sort of pioneering in a way, and it was sort of difficult because we had to the comet was moving, and basically the pointing systems were based on fixed stars. So if you launched one day at a given time, you had to tell the rocket pointing mechanism, the ACS, it's called, attitude control system, where the comet was going to be. We didn't have, now in Stanley rockets we have joysticks, so we can move things around. You can move the pointing around, we can steer it with jets. But if you fail to launch on one day because of wind or weather or something like that, you have to get in there and completely reprogram the ACS because the comet would be in a different part of the sky. And so it was pretty awful working with morning launches. You observe the comet before the sun rose, and so you had to be, you're launching at 4:30 in the morning or something like that. It was quite exciting, actually.
Because have you read the book Picturing the Cosmos, Elizabeth Kessler?
No.
Does it mention, there used to be almost a nostalgia. So it reminded me of that, of astronomers working late at night and then coming out in the morning, seeing, because they're on an observatory, so they see a sprawling view and they're drinking coffee in the morning. But is that changed? Do you still get that?
I've never been a real astronomer.
Just viewing, okay.
I've never gone to an observatory. I've been to observatories, but I've never, done any major work in an observatory and never done all night. Well, that's not completely true. My daughter reminded me that when NASA put up the first ultraviolet, it wasn't the first, but it was the first facility instrument, the International Ultraviolet Explorer, was launched in 78, and it operated for something like 19 years. And the control center was in Goddard, and it was a small telescope, maybe 10 inches across, and it had old detectors, but it was unique. It was in geosynchronous orbit, so it observed 24 hours a day. It was shared between the U.S. and Europe, so we had 16 hours, they had 8 hours, and there were 8-hour shifts. And being that I and my colleagues were living close to Goddard, we always got Christmas and Thanksgiving, and we would get, depending on where the satellite was in orbit, we would sometimes get a shift that ran from 8 in the evening to 4 in the morning. So.
Wow.
And then I'd have to drive back on the Baltimore-Washington Parkway at 5 in the morning.
That's not too nostalgic.
but that was good. So they have this little control panel, which is, probably the iPhone can do more than those panels, but they have them on display at the Lieberhasi branch of the National Air and Space Museum near Dulles Airport. And so she sent me a photograph of it because she remembers when I used to come home early in the morning after an all-nighter there.
Damn, that brought back the memories. One sec. You covered so many of my questions in one thing, so sorry if I pause. I have to skip through a bunch of them. So I guess this is not in any particular order, these two, but were you around through the implementation of CCDs on
just because not on Hubble,
just
it was done on the Wide Field Planetary Camera.
Yeah,
but I was involved on a team which was using which was developing a camera for a mission that never happened. It was called the Comet Rendezvous Asteroid Flyby. It was a NASA mission. It's a sort of a strange story because NASA, having its big missions to following Voyager and Galileo, having big planetary missions, decided they could build one spacecraft that can do multiple missions. So they designed a spacecraft that could be used for both a comet mission, a comet craft, as I just described, and a Saturn mission. And then they found that whereas they originally thought they could build two spacecraft for the price of one, they found they could only build one spacecraft for the price of one. So they canceled Kraft and flew Cassini, which has been very successful at Saturn. So as a member of one of the science teams for Kraft, we developed and Kraft was supposed to go first. We developed a camera. I wasn't really involved in the instrumentation, but CCDs were in their infancy, and so we were, you know, dealing with the development and procurement of CCDs from various vendors. That was back in the late 80s, early 90s, and at the same time they were doing the same thing for Hubble, and they had early generation CCDs. We also tried to fly CCDs in a sounding rocket early on. I can't remember, because they had to be cool. I can't remember if we were successful or not. I think we probably weren't, but I don't remember. It doesn't stick in my memory.
But yeah, that sounds like a triviality.
I think in the mid-90s we tried a CCD-based ultraviolet detector. We ended up using position-sensitive detectors of different kinds, ultimately based on microchannel place. But the CCD always had the problem that if you're working in the ultraviolet and you transfer, you convert the UV photons into visible photons for the CCD, you're still not blocking all of visible photons that can go get in directly and can swamp the signal from the UV photons. So they were never very... They were never very useful for the ultraviolet. They're great for visible imaging.
Mm-hmm.
Every instrument uses them now.
Oh, it's become I guess it's the standard. Yeah. Were you so you joined the committee on the Hubble in 1992? I wasn't sure the position.
Committee.
It said on your Hopkins not your blog but your profile you were on the maybe observatory committee for the Hubble. From 1992 to 1995?
Oh, that was the users committee.
Oh, okay.
Okay. There were lots of committees for Hubble.
Oh, yeah.
Committees, and yeah, I was on the users committee.
Could I hear about your the details of your job just in a
little bit? I don't remember very much. We went to meetings and we had presentations. Oh, I know why I was on the committee. When Hubble was developed, one of the PIs of the instruments, Jack Brandt, who was then at Goddard, who developed the Goddard high-resolution spectrograph, his team did anyway, was interested in observing Halley's Comet, which was supposed to, Hubble was supposed to be launched in 85 or 86, and that was when Halley's Comet was visible. So they wrote a specification that Hubble should be able to track moving targets on the sky up to the limit at which Halley's Comet would be moving. And then they never really implemented. It was something like 2 milliard seconds per second. It was a relatively low rate. I mean, but these objects, the planets move across. They move. They're not fixed, right?
Mm-hmm, you know that? Yeah.
So when we started making observations of planets with Hubble, we found that they didn't have the software implemented to track them properly. They would have to use some guide stars. They would have to point at the planet, and then after a certain amount of time, they have to go back to the guide stars and change the plane. They couldn't track continuously. There was some problem. So in fact, my role in that committee was simply to advocate for a proper moving target capability, which they have now. But it's not so trivial when you're trying to maintain pointing to you know, several milliard seconds to be able to do that. You know, you use reaction wheels and you have all sorts of
visual
errors and things like that. That's all I remember. Mainly it was a lot of presentations on the status of the observatory and then of course that was close to the first repair mission.
Oh yeah.
So that was very important.
Were you around for the flawed mirror?
Oh yeah. Well, my mentor here, Bill Fasti, was one of the telescope scientists, and he till the day he died, I guess in 2001, he blamed himself for not discovering the flaw in the telescope, because basically the people, the committees, the outside committees, were kept away from the details of the instrumentation, even though he was an expert in optics, and that's why he was appointed as a telescope scientist. They actually made two mirrors, and they had two contractors, and Perkin Elmer in Connecticut was the prime contractor. I think Kodak in Rochester was the second contractor. They were building a backup mirror, and the error was made at Perkin Elmer. And after they inspected it, and the inspection was what was flawed, when they inspected it, they decided to go ahead with the primary and leave the second mirror unfinished, in other words, not polished to final smooth. And it turns out the second mirror was done correctly.
Okay, the first one was...
The first one was a flawed one. And that's an interesting... That's an interesting story. But then, Holland Ford, who, I don't know whether you're interviewing him or someone's interviewing him.
Sure, someone is.
He was one of the PIs on the instrument to correct the spherical aberration. They built it in a set of mirrors that they would put in front of the, you know, following the telescope, but in front of the instruments, called COSCAR, which would correct for the spherical aberration. And then feed the instruments that were in there. Now the newest instruments, none of the old instruments are there anymore, but the new instruments all have the correction built in.
It's interesting.
That was pretty hairy. I was at a scientific meeting, trying to remember, it was 1990, and it was, the launch was 1990 because we're having the 25th celebration this year. And the launch was in April 24th or 25th. And I went to the launch that was canceled, and then I didn't go back for the second attempt when they did launch it. The shuttle always had problems with launches. There was a meeting of the International Astronomical Union in The Hague in June, and I remember someone showing up and saying, well, they just discovered the flaw with the mirror. And it was great stunned silence in the room.
Just like, oh, no, you said it was
1990?
Oh, man, because they set it up in April of 1990 or
they
something.
They set it up.
Yeah, so it must have been, like, just after. That's frustrating.
Well, it takes a while, right?
Yeah.
When you set something up, it takes a while.
To get data, but I'm sure once they, you know, it's within the same year, it's got to be disheartening for a little bit.
It didn't affect the spectrographs as much as the images.
What was wrong with the images when they came back? Like, how was it evident that they were flawed?
They were blurry. I mean,
it was like a
collaboration gives you rings. It's very clear. Well,
definitely.
They had to figure out where it was, where the problem was, and then they figured out a way
You said they put that the device in front of the mirror.
They put it behind the mirror.
To correct it. You said right.
Well, you've got the primary mirror, you've got a secondary up front, and then the light comes through and then gets fed into the different instruments.
Okay.
And what you do is you put something in to correct the optics.
Because would it have been too costly or too difficult to make a new mirror? I don't know how it works at all.
No,
so.
You have to bring it back.
Okay, entirely. You have to bring it to... It's tough to service that in space. All right, you have to open it up, I'm sure. To lose a screw out of it. That'd be bad. Let's see, that cut through a lot of them, actually. Could you speak a little bit about the Hubble's role if you were around for, I guess, because I think the Hubble, from what I read, was just not revolutionized, but it changed the way we view space and the way that the public views space. And did it affect, like, the funding of projects or?
Well, the funding of Hubble itself was very controversial for a long time, and because it was so expensive, just like this JWST had lots of overruns because the technology they're trying to implement is new and relatively risk prone. Hubble was it's just been a great thing for PR, you know, for NASA.
Yeah, so.
But even after it was repaired and successfully operated, there were certain members of Congress who said, well, we've gotten great data, let's shut it down now and not have to fund it anymore. So
I'm sure,
it's been a struggle, but yeah. But it's been a very good enterprise. Have you seen any of the exhibits across the street? Have you been over there?
No, I haven't. At the
Space Museum?
Yeah, I've seen the building, but I always,
in the lobby.
Do they get the data from the Hubble there, out of curiosity?
They don't get it directly. They get it from Goddard, but they process it there.
Okay.
And they distribute it to people like me from over there. And then when you're doing planetary or cometary observations and you have moving targets, you work with someone over there to schedule it so that it's at a time when you can see those targets and track them. Some of the things we've tried to do with the satellites of Jupiter is to see a satellite going into or coming out of eclipse behind the planet. And the timing on that is very, very, very tricky.
Huh. Yeah, so I have to imagine that must be the precise little...
Well, you have to know exactly
where
the spacecraft is relative to where the planet and its satellite is.
Yeah. And then I guess, are there any main goals in the field of astronomy that, I guess, and this might be a poor comparison, but I know in physics they had the, making sure that's, they had the Higgs boson, that everyone went to, you know, it seemed like a goal for the industry, so to speak.
Well, there were key projects for the Hubble when it started, and there are key projects now for JWST when it gets launched. But, for instance, the measurement of the Hubble constant, how fast the universe is expanding.
Oh, that's interesting.
And the discovery of dark energy wasn't anticipated. It came from careful measurement, mainly using Hubble to measure distances to supernovae. So you always have key ideas that you want. For instance, what JWST wants to do is look back at the time when the first galaxies were formed after the inflation following the Big Bang. But you always find things that you don't expect, and that's the beauty of science, right?